Okay, so for the rest of you, I want you to think about something for me this morning. So I want you to think about, if you can remember back that far, I want you to think about your first date. Okay? Everybody got it? Got it in your head? First date? Thinking about it? Okay, so, everybody got it? Everybody got it in their head? Okay, so think about some of the things that were important for you to find out on that first date. So let me give you a quick example. So I think, obviously, you're thinking about, like, if you're eating food together, you're thinking about the other person's going to see what you're eating and all that kind of stuff. And so I'll give you an example on Heidi and I's first date. Do you remember what I had, Heidi, to eat? What was it?
Ham and cheese sub.
Ham and cheese sub. Okay, so I went with the ham and cheese sub because I knew that, like, pasta, I was going to get it all over myself. Anything else, it was probably going to be not good. And so I credit that ham and cheese sub to the fact that we made it, that we got married,
never
we're still together.
Because
I haven't ordered one since, right? I don't even really like ham and cheese subs, but it was clean and it was easy. And I knew that I wasn't going to get it on myself, so I went with the ham and cheese sub, okay? Because I knew that, just knew I had to do that. So there's some things that are important to find out on your first date, right? Like just what the person likes, interests, hobbies, okay? But there's some more important things that you got to find out down the line. So what are some of those things? I want to ask you guys, like, for your participation this morning, what are those things that you want to find out early on in your relationship? Any thoughts?
If they want a
family. Yeah. Family? If they want family, great. Great answer. Any others?
Their morals.
Their morals, right. How? What are they? Morals, what do they believe? What are their values? That's great. Any other thoughts?
Their faith.
What about their faith? Okay, and that's a great answer. That's going to lead us into what we're talking about today. So when you think about, like, what's the most important thing about a person, right? What is the most important thing about us? Is it what we do? Is it what we say? Is it how much we have? Is it our political beliefs? Okay, or is it something different? There's a guy named A.W. Tozer. He says this. He says, what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. What comes into our minds when we think about God? That is what is most important. So I want to ask you today, what comes into your mind when you think about God? Do you imagine God as an old man dressed in white? Do you imagine him as close to you, or as distant, far away? Do you think he's kind of like this old grandpa that's kind of losing his memory? Do you think of him as this oppressive tyrant that has a lot of rules? What do you think about? Like, what picture, what image comes into your mind when you think about God? What's he like? What's he not like? What would he say? What would he do? What does he think? That is the most important thing about you and me, is what we think about when we think about God. And why that is important, A.W. Tozer, he goes on and says this: for this reason, the gravest question before us is always God himself. And the most important fact about any man is not what he at any given time may say or do, but what he in his deep heart conceives God to be like. We tend by a secret law of the soul to move toward our mental image of God. So what he's saying there is that whatever we think about God is most important, because that's what's going to move us. That's what's going to directly influence how we live our lives. Let me try to give you an example. So if we picture God as this harsh and unfair tyrant or judge, then that will cause us to live our lives in fear, and that will cause us to live in harshness toward others around us. Or on the opposite side, if we picture God as kind of like that grandpa who's losing his memory, can't keep the rules straight, then we probably won't live in with any regard to God's laws, or God's rules, or his instruction for our lives, and we'll live apart from those laws, okay? Or if we see him as distant, kind of passive, then we'll think, well, why do we need God? If he's just distant and passive, I don't see a need for him in our lives. But if we see him for who he truly is, if you see God for who he truly is, you won't be able to do anything except for worship him. And so that is the most important thing. And that's the question we're really looking at. We're going to look at for a while is God in this series called God Has a Name. Just basic. Who is God and what is he like? Now, if you're anything like me, you're probably thinking, well, how can we know what God is like? Right? How can a human know what God is like? Let me give you a quick story about myself. So I'm a natural skeptic. I used to be a science teacher. So I like evidence. like empirical evidence. Right, Cam? You like empirical? We like evidence as science people. Like, that's how we're wired. Okay, and so as a kid or as a teenager, I remember there was this country song by George Strait. Any of you like George Strait? Okay, I just remember that song. I don't really listen to a lot. But anyways, there was a song and it says, "I saw God today." Okay, it's a song about like flowers and babies. And he says in the song, "I saw God today." And me as a skeptic, I'm just, you saw flowers and a baby. Like, you didn't see God. I remember like being like angry when I heard that song, because how can we know what God is like? How can we see God? And what I didn't understand then in that point in my life was something called divine revelation, that God has to make himself known. In order to be known, he has to reveal himself. See, the Bible teaches that we all have this veil over our eyes. When we're born into the world, we don't just have a natural understanding of God instantly. Okay, we're born with this veil that blinds our minds and it hardens our heart. That was my problem. Growing up, I was not a believer. My heart was hardened towards God, and only God revealing himself could change that. No matter how hard I tried to understand, it doesn't matter how smart you are, how kind you are, how strong you are, we can't know God unless God reveals himself to us. And so this happens in two different ways. This happens in two different ways. I know this is kind of theological, but it's also really important to understand, okay? So there's general revelation and specific revelation. General is like God reveals himself in nature through creation or just through our humanity or our conscience. This basic concept of like all of us have this basic understanding of God because we can look outside and see trees and see things and see everything that he made. And so on one level, we already have this. Everybody has the general revelation, this general knowledge that there is a God. This is the reason that even people who describe themselves as atheists start to pray when the plane starts going down. That's because of general revelation, because everyone deep down knows that that God is real. But there's also specific revelation. General revelation is not enough to save us, to cause us to have this relationship with God. We need specific revelation, which comes through the person of Jesus. It comes through historical events that have happened, and it comes through scripture. Today, the number one thing, the way that God reveals himself is through the Bible, is through scripture. And that's why the Bible is so important. Okay, and I'm saying this long intro to get us to just understand why this is important, why we have to start at ground zero. So if you do have a Bible today with you, we're going to start this series in the book of Exodus. This is the second book of the Bible. So right after Genesis. This was the book in the Bible where, this is like the first place in history where God started to reveal himself to a large number of people. He started to lift that veil. And now for the first time in human history, God has a name that we could understand him by. He was no longer kind of the disengaged, impersonal creator of the world, but he was the personal, engaged creator who interacted with his creation. So today we're going to look at Exodus chapter 1 and 2. But over the next several weeks, we're going to look at the personal name of God, which we learn about in Exodus. We're going to actually talk about that next week. We're going to look at other names that describe God in other weeks. Okay, and like I said before, the goal that we're going to try to answer through this series is, who is God and what is he like? Okay, very basic initial things. So as we dive into Exodus chapter 1 and 2, we got to kind of get the background of the story, right? So if you're not familiar with the big picture story of the Bible, Genesis chapter 1, God creates the world, but then Genesis chapter 3, the world falls into sin. Adam and Eve rebel against God, and that's the reason we have sin today. Then there's the fall, then there's the flood. And then in Genesis chapter 12, God comes to this guy. His name was Abram. He promises Abram that he's going to make a great nation that would bless all of humanity. And so God promised Abraham, and then his name is eventually changed into Abraham. Abraham has a son, Isaac, who has a son, Jacob. Jacob eventually gets his name changed to Israel. Israel has 12 sons. Okay, long story short, Israel and his 12 sons end up in Egypt. And that's where the book of Genesis ends. So you've got Israel, which is about 70 people by this time. This family of Israel in Egypt, And you have this promise that God has made, and you're kind of left wondering at the end of the book of Genesis, okay, what is going to happen next? What about the promise that God made to Abraham? How is this family of 70 people living in a foreign land going to be a blessing to the whole world like God promised? So let's dive into that in Exodus 1. The first thing we see is how Israel multiplied. Look at verses 6 and 7. It says, "Then Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them." So 400 years had passed by. 400 years of time. This is lots of time to be fruitful and multiply, right? So they had grown a lot over that 400 years. That's a long time to be able to grow. But it was a new generation with new people. And so Israel started to be oppressed by the new Pharaoh who was in charge. Verse 9, we see what Pharaoh says to his people. He said, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." So his solution, the Pharaoh, is to, okay, let's make them slaves so that they can't keep growing and so that they don't get more powerful. So they put Israel into ruthless slavery. Eventually, one of the other things that they said, Pharaoh said to the midwives of the Hebrews, he says, kill the first son, or kill actually all the sons that are Hebrew sons. And we learned later on in chapter 1, verse 17, the midwives didn't do that, okay? But the midwives feared God, it says, and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and let the male children live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them." What a great comeback from the midwives, right? They're kind of insult the Egyptian women at the same time of defending why they were doing what they were doing. So basically, you get this picture in chapter 1. Okay, the Israelites, they're multiplying. The Pharaoh tries to stop them from multiplying by these harsh rules, slavery, kill the sons, and they keep multiplying right through that. So finally, Pharaoh commands the whole nation, okay, throw every Hebrew boy, that baby boy that is born, into the Nile River. That's kind of where chapter 1 ends. So chapter 1, Pharaoh's trying to oppress them. He's putting them in slavery. He's trying to kill off the Hebrew people. And then in chapter 2, we see the birth of this man who eventually becomes by the name of Moses. So look at verses 1 through 3. "Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that the child, that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. When she could no longer hide him, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank." Okay, ironically, she actually did, if you think about it, she did what Pharaoh told them to do. She said, put them all in the Nile River. She did it, but she just gave him a flotation device so that he would live. Okay, so eventually, if you know the story, Pharaoh's daughter finds the baby and has compassion for the baby. She finds a Hebrew woman who was his mother, to nurse the baby. And when the baby got older, he became her son. He's given this Hebrew name, which means to pull out of water. That's what Moses actually means. So this is when Moses was born. Moses' name means to pull or draw out of water. Okay, and then finally, the last kind of section of chapter 2, we're just trying to give you this overview of it right now, is when Moses flees. So Moses gets older, and by the time he's about age 40, as he was raised in the Egyptian culture, he got in some trouble. He saw an Egyptian person beating a Hebrew person, and so he killed the Egyptian, and he hid the body. But some of the Hebrews, they found out, like they saw it happen, and Moses eventually starts to hear, okay, like some people know this is happening. He starts to be afraid that he's going to get caught, and so he runs away. Eventually, Pharaoh finds out as well, and he runs away, and Scripture tells us he runs away to this place called Midian. Okay, this is going to be important for understanding the whole picture of the book of Exodus later, so that's why I want to show you this on the map. Okay, so you've got Egypt, upper left-hand side of the picture, and then you've got Midian, which is circled in the lower right-hand side of the picture across from across the Sinai Peninsula. Then you see where Midian is. So that's going to come up later just to understand kind of where this is at in the world. But when he gets to Midian, he comes to this well. And there's this these people there, these ladies that are there at the well. And they're kind of being harassed by some men. And so Moses does the right thing. He does the good thing. He saves the women. He helps them water their flock. He kind of kicks the guys out of there that were harassing them. And then we read this. The women came home to their father, Reuel, and he said, "How is it that you've come home so soon today?" They said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Then where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." Okay, so Moses saves them. Then they come back to their father and say, "Somebody saved us." And so he's like, "Get him. What are you doing? Tell him to come on over." Okay, Moses earns some points here with dad. And so dad, Reuel, gives him one of his daughters named Zipporah to marry him. And so Moses would actually go on and live in this area for another 40 years. He gets married to Zipporah. He has children with her. And Moses is living. So Moses, the first 40 years of his life is spent in Egypt. Then the next 40 years is spent in this land called Midian. And that's kind of where chapter 2 kind of ends and leads us in the big picture story of Exodus. Okay, that's important. To all that background information is going to be important for us to remember going forward. And that's why I share it. But what I want to get to next is the end of chapter 2. Okay, because that's really where we're going to land the plane for today. We're going to focus on these verses right at the end of chapter 2. Chapter 2, verses 23 through 25. So it says this: "During those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew." Okay, I just want us to think about these verses today. First, let's look at this. Israel groaned because of their slavery. Just think about that word, groaning. Like, they are going through a hard, like, hard doesn't even describe it, right? The Bible says that this specific slavery was ruthless, was harsh, it was bitter, and it was a type of slavery that was not just trying to get work out of them, but it was aimed at destroying their morale, destroying their humanity. And so they cry out to God. They are groaning because they are in slavery. And then we read that God heard their groaning. This word in Hebrew is shema. It means to listen and also respond. So it's not just like he heard it and didn't care, didn't do anything. It's to listen and respond. It's to listen and reply. And so he heard it. He wanted to hear it. He listened. He was going to respond to their cry for help. Then a little bit later, we see God remembered. God remembered his covenant with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Okay, he remembered, but technically he never forgot. Okay, it's not saying that he forgot and then remembered 400 years later. It's just from a human perspective, it seems like, oh, now he's remembering. But he never forgot the whole time. The whole 400 years, he knew he had a plan. He had a timetable for when he was going to step in and fulfill his promises to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. So 400 years later, that was the time. He remembered that covenant that he had made. That covenant means an agreement or a promise. He remembers it. And then we see the next important word. God saw the people of Israel. This word for saw, it means to fix your eyes upon something, to look at something with concern. So he sees with concern the people of Israel. There's a great passage in the book of Genesis a little bit earlier that just to look at real quick to understand this scene, this is the way that God sees us. Okay, so in the book of Genesis, there's this woman named Hagar, and there's actually a lot of parallels between Hagar and the story of Exodus, which is interesting because Hagar was actually an Egyptian slave. So the roles are opposite there. It's kind of reversed. Hagar was an Egyptian slave of Abraham's wife, Sarah. And so if you know the story, basically Sarah, she tells Abraham to have a child with Hagar. Then she gets mad at Hagar and treats her poorly. So she's treated harshly, and then she flees. She runs away to the desert. But in the desert, God appears to her, and God comforts her. And in Genesis 16, he says, she says to him, "You are a God of seeing." For she said, "Truly, I have seen him who looks after me." Okay, he says, "You are a God of seeing." And she gives God this name. In Hebrew, it's El Roy. Okay, and that means the God who sees me. Okay, this is the first name that we're looking at, El Roy. God is El Roy. He's the God who sees me. So God sees, just like he saw Hagar in the wilderness, he sees the Egyptian people, or he sees the Israelites, he sees their slavery, and God knew. Okay, last word, God knew. That word for knew, or know, is another one of those really interesting Bible words. Because there's so many different meanings or so many different ways that that word is used. Okay, and one of them is the word for sexual union. Okay, I don't want to get graphic today, but the word yada or new is the word for sexual union in the Hebrew Bible. So when it talks about Adam and Eve knew each other and then they had a baby, this is the word yada or new. And so it's a word that describes an intimacy and a closeness similar to that of union between a husband and a wife. It's to know and to care deeply. It's to really understand someone else. So think about that picture it's giving us. God knew. Okay, God knew. He was intimate. He was close with that situation. He cared deeply about them. Okay, and today, to bring this kind of to our lives today in full circle, something that we struggle with as a culture and we can struggle with as individuals at time is this belief called deism. Now, a lot of people are deistic or believe in deism, but don't even really understand what that is. Okay, so deism is this belief that God created the world, but he's not currently interacting with creation. He kind of just kicked things off, started it, got it all kicked off, and now he kind of just sits back and doesn't really care about how the world, what happens in the world today. Okay, the truth is we can be Christians, but sometimes live like deists. This worldview is kind of one of those that can be appealing to people because they believe in God still, right? There's still a God. He's still there. He still will save us, but he doesn't interfere with our daily life. He doesn't meddle too much in our lives. And so there's this thing, it's called deism, that we can struggle with. But this passage in all these words help us understand that that is not true. Okay, it reminds us that God is present. This is a picture for us. I want to remind you, okay, let me go back to this one. God hears all these same words. These five red highlighted words that apply to them, they all apply to us. First one is this, groaning. Okay, this is a picture for us. The Bible describes us without Jesus, without God in our life. It describes that as slavery. Just like the Israelites were slaves and groaned in their slavery, we are slaves to sin if we do not have Jesus in our life. Let me remind you, if you weren't here last week, we did this cycle. You can go back and listen to it on the podcast if you want. But just real briefly, when we don't have God in our life, when we live without God, whether that's on a daily basis or over a whole lifetime, there's this cycle of shame, which leads to loneliness, which leads to anxiety, which leads to chasing after something, whether that's success or money or fame, which leads to escape into our addictions, whether that's pornography or money or whatever addiction you might have, which leads us to resentment, which leads us to back to shame. And there's this cycle, okay? And it is literally like slavery. Okay? If we live life without God, which, like I said last week, sometimes if you just look at my life on a day, one day, that I kind of choose to live apart from relationship with Jesus, my life looks like that. Okay, it can be that cycle sometimes. And so that, like, we know that is slavery. That is no fun. And so we groan. Life is not fun when we live in that cycle. And we groan and we should cry out to God. That should cause us to cry out to him, just like the Israelites did. We should cry out to God. We should pray to God. Help us, right? Help us. We need your help. Just like they did, we need your help in destroying that cycle of sin in our lives. So we need God's help. And we know that when we do that, God will hear us. God will remember us. Just like he remembered his covenant with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, God will remember the covenant that he has with us. Now, that covenant is a little bit different today. If you know anything about covenants in the Bible, okay, that was the old covenant. This is the new covenant today. We have a new covenant through Jesus. But God still gives us that same love and attention through the new covenant relationship that we have with Jesus. Okay, so just like one thing that I just want to touch on too is just like back then when God remembered the covenant, it was 400 years after. We got to remember that, right? So it took 400 years of slavery and of crying out for eventually God to change their circumstance, for God to rescue them from that circumstance. So just because we know God will remember us when we cry out to him, it doesn't always mean that our circumstance is going to immediately change, right? It doesn't mean that the sickness is going to go away. It doesn't mean that we're going to get that new job or whatever that might be. Because think about it. It took 400 years for the Israelites to have their circumstances changed. But what it does mean is that even if your circumstances don't change, he hears you. God is there. He sees you. He cares. He knows everything about you. Okay? And he sees and he cares. Right? We can all struggle with that. I know that I can, right? Does anyone really see me? Does anyone really notice me for who I am? Does anyone care about what I do? Or like if my life was like a social media post, would they just scroll right by it? Does anybody really see? Does anybody care? Would God see? Listen, God is El Roy. He's the God who sees. God sees you and he knows you. If you take anything away from today, just take that. God sees you. He knows you and he cares. Okay, he sees all the hurt in your life, all of the pain, all of the relationships that are broken. God sees you and he cares about you in those things. He sees all of the work that you do. He sees all of the labor that you put in behind the scenes that no one else does. He sees the faithfulness that you have in reading your scripture or in coming to church. He sees the sacrifices that you make on a daily basis for other people. And he also sees our stubbornness and our rebellion and our sin. He sees all of it and he still loves you. He still wants a relationship with you. Whenever it's the middle of the night and you're awake with the baby and you're thinking, am I ever going to sleep again? God sees you then, right? If it's 100 degrees and you're at work and you feel like the day's never going to end and your boss is annoying you, he sees you then. Whatever it is, whether your family is like falling apart and life feels like it's unraveling, God sees you and God knows and he cares. So take that away from today. He cares. He knows. Who is God and what is he like? He's El Roy. El Roy. He cares and he knows. Yeah, Joel.
Real quick.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Word is zakar, and it actually means to more of perform a remembrance. So it's like putting feet, hands, and mouth in action to, do a remembrance of that covenant. So it kind of pointed to God, taking action.
That makes sense. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. So it's not like he's remembering it like, oh, I forgot about that, but he's about to put it to action. That's great. Thanks, Joel. So as I was saying, who is God? What is he like? Remember, he is El Roy. He's the God who sees you. He sees you and knows you, and he cares. Just want to leave us with this today. Heidi's going to come up and lead us in a couple of songs. But there's a great verse in 1 Peter 5:7 in the New Testament that I try to remember when I just, you can remember this on a daily basis. Like, I think I need to remember this definitely on an hourly basis in my life. Cast your cares on him, for he cares for you. Okay, God cares. He's somebody that you can bring your cares to, all your anxieties, all of your worries. He wants you to bring those things. So again, if you take anything away from today, this is the point. God sees you, he knows your situation, and he cares. And that is amazing in itself, right? That is enough to change the way that you look.